Friends and listeners, today's episode is a special episode, and I'll give you a bit of the background of why I decided to release an episode on this topic of navigating a mental health tragedy here in a second. But for a podcast dedicated to creator and business psychology, it actually seemed a worthy endeavor to record a short but unique episode on how to navigate a worst case scenario for someone you may know and love. It's the statistics on mental illness are pretty staggering. 1 in 5 dealing with a mental illness currently is the estimation for Americans, and I think it's a broad, generally acceptable estimation for the world. And 1 in 20 are currently dealing with a significant mental illness, something like schizophrenia or bipolar. So it's quite common. That means that those that are indirectly affected by someone with a mental illness is pretty much 100%. If you have a family of 5, if you've got an extended family, more than 5 people, if you have colleagues, if you've got community members, neighbors, which most of us have, one or all of these, then the chances that you are or will be directly or indirectly affected by mental illness is pretty much 100%. The background on this episode is one of my good friends. His brother took his own life about 5 days ago. And about 5 days ago is the anniversary of when my sister took her own life when I was about 15. Growing up, the first time I really heard the word and diagnosis of depression was the day after my sister took her own life. I don't think I ever really heard the idea of crippling anxiety until I was maybe in my 20s. I don't think I ever heard the concept of any type of disorder around something as pervasive as anxiety until my 20s. I have a college friend that he drinks about 4 or 5 drinks a night, and alcoholic drinks, and his fingernails are bitten down to stubs, and kind of leg shaking quite often when you're around him, and extremely thoughtful, sweet, smart individual. And one of the most unique experiences, interactions I've ever had around the topic of mental health was about 2 years ago when I asked him how long he had been dealing with anxiety. And I know there's 50% of me says, oh, that's, who am I to diagnose anyone with dealing with anything? The other half of me also recognized that something was happening beneath the surface. And when I asked him how long he had been dealing with anxiety, because he was talking about how he needed to stop biting his nails, and he showed me his hand, and it, and he's a 35-year-old man with, there's blood around his nails, and they were 1/3 the size of a typical human nail. And he looked at me and said, anxiety, what do you mean? I don't have anxiety. And I certainly was not in any setting to make a diagnosis or push the issue, but I've thought about that a number of times afterwards, this seemingly innocuous exchange for me with a sister that suffered with depression for months before our family, or I heard the diagnosis our family, my parents had, for the stat that from first symptom to diagnosis, as the average time span is 10 years here in the U.S., from first symptom of mental illness to diagnosis, is 10 years. Having this kind of background information, that exchange sums up so much about my observation with mental illness. Is the symptoms, the signs, the suffering is there, and yet it's often invisible to even the person suffering from it. At least the diagnosis, the understanding of many of these disorders that actually we have great information, great resources, great science backing extremely powerful treatments for. But to have a disease or disorder is bad enough, to not know you have it is worse and can be fatal. So I wanted to record this episode for the family members that might be the friends that might be on the other side of a tragedy. Again, I will touch on some of the resources for how to avoid the tragedy itself, but I've never really seen a great resource for the community that's sitting on the other side of a tragedy. And after 20 years of multiple times a year being someone that people reach out to when a family member takes their own life or a friend takes their own life, because of my experience early on, I figured it might be worth a few minutes to talk about how I personally approach this topic. This is all my personal opinion. I am not an expert, not a professional, but it's something that I've become attuned to. You can't help but to turn your antenna towards this, the topic of mental health, after a tragedy within your own family, especially when you know that there's a chance that it can happen again. So there's both the understanding of what had just happened and the attempt to understand how you can avoid it happening again. The number one thing that I find myself telling people is that what can result in suicide is a disorder. Suicide is not just a choice, an acute decision that's made one evening or one afternoon, but it is the result of an accumulation of thoughts of suffering, of a disorder of the mind, that I often think about it like diabetes of the mind, where if you know someone that's suffering from diabetes, there is no cure for it, and you cannot have a conversation with them to get them out of it. curing someone of diabetes is not one, two, or three conversations away. It's not saying the right thing, putting the right words in the right order. It's not about you doing more, needing to have done more. It's not about you doing too little or you doing the wrong things. We know enough about diabetes to know that it is not something that can just be talked away. And I think it is not a perfect, but it is, in my view, an apt metaphor for things like major depression or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, where it is an affliction of the mind that, like diabetes, might have 20% of the equation, might be due to the behavior and choices of that individual that can make the symptoms and the suffering worse or better, but the large majority of the equation is not what they decide or what they don't decide to do on that Tuesday or that Wednesday when tragedy happens. I know a few people that suffer from bipolar and have for a few decades, and I can say that it is a disorder. I have a heart condition, and it is a disorder like having a heart condition. There are symptoms and swings that happen biochemically and emotionally and behaviorally that you couldn't just have a phone call with me and it would go away, or do the right Googling, and even if you went through training, a 12-week course of the best ways to help someone with a heart condition, that might be some helpful assistance, but at the end of the day, there is something happening beneath the surface that is not in any way a choice by anyone involved. And the last decade, we've actually become closer to world peace than inner peace. I'll link to citations of the different things that I mentioned in this brief episode, but you are nearly twice as more likely. The average human is twice as more likely to die of self-inflicted wound or self-harm than they are to die of violent crime or warfare combined globally. And in some demographics, that trend line, the seriousness of this and the mental illness is going in the wrong direction. It is accelerating in certain demographics. My sister took her life when she was 19, and that's one of the demographics where it is climbing. Where suicide rates are climbing, and that is within teenagers and adolescents. It actually overtook homicide a few years ago as a leading cause of death, of premature death for adolescents. And though part of this episode is meant for, as the title suggests, navigating a mental health tragedy as it's already happened, I think our understanding, our discussion, the awareness of the prevalence of such a massive epidemic of mental illness is certainly part of this conversation and should be part of nearly every conversation. Because at the end of the day, when trying to understand a tragedy, a big part of us is also trying to understand how to avoid one in the future. the three biggest causes for someone to go from first symptom to 10 years later actually getting a diagnosis. One of the biggest is the lack of awareness of just how prevalent mental illness is. The second, and again, we'll link to the citations, is the social stigma around such a diagnosis. So the denial is really strong because you really don't want to admit to yourself or to your community, to your family, that there might be something, wrong with the current biochemistry of your brain, or something. I even hesitate to say that because who knows what science will find out in 10 years, in 20 years. Many cases of depression are actually linked to issues with immunoresponses within us, and it isn't a biochemistry in your mind so much as it is in your brain, so much as it can actually be a misfiring of your immune system. So I hesitate to even try to describe what could be causing the disorder, but that none of that has to do with the social stigma that is as prevalent as the illness itself, for people to want to avoid taking the fact that they may have a mental illness seriously. But I think one of the biggest things that can erode that stigma is when someone has an illness or is going through one or has gone through one, talking openly about that illness. I have dealt indirectly now for a couple decades with mental illness, people close to me, and I struggled with depression for about 18 months several years ago. And one of the most powerful things that I saw that was helpful for me was being able to talk to someone that got to the other side of it. I've heard depression described as the inability to create a future. That inability to imagine a future, when I think about that definition, I think about all of the people that I know that found themselves in that deep, dark, distorted gravity well of despair. It's such a vanilla sounding definition, the inability to create or imagine a future. And yet, if you've been there, or if you know someone that has been there, it's almost like, what else can you say? Imagine your future fading to black. But talking about it openly, especially if you found yourself on the other side of that deep, dark well, where you were able to create and imagine a future on the other side of thinking you never would again, then you become a lighthouse for anyone that finds themselves in that situation. I've been there and I talk about that openly on the podcast and in my social professional life. And you never know who that is going to resonate with, or when you might get a text or an email or a phone call 5 months later, 2 years later, from someone that finds themselves in that circumstance and is looking for someone that found their way out. And the truth is, there are so many people, the majority of people with major depression, major mental illness, do not commit suicide. And 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 20 means there are a lot of survivors that you can reach out to. There, I will link to resources online in this episode, and there are some great ones online, especially as I record this at the end of 2022. There are more convenient, private resources online from your couch, from your bed, from your phone, than ever existed 10 years ago, 20 years ago. One of the third major reason people do not reach out to seek a diagnosis is the perceived and actual cost of treatment. But that is plummeting with things that people can use online. Services like BetterHelp or Cerebral for everything from ongoing therapy to prescriptions. It has never been more cost effective and more convenient than today. I also think that the amount that we talk about these illnesses and their prevalence has never been higher. The openness is changing, perhaps generationally, but I think it's also because of this understanding that is growing, that this is not a choice. I remember someone saying suicide was a permanent decision for a temporary situation. And I remember thinking, after my sister passed away, how stupid that decision, that description was. That is, saying suicide is a decision is like saying diabetes is a decision, or a symptom of the flu is a decision. I want to underscore that I do firmly believe there are decisions before those symptoms that can accumulate positively or negatively, that can be in that person's control. And I take a wild, maybe irresponsible, broad stroke estimation to say maybe it's those decisions towards building and maintaining and developing mental wealth, mental fitness, those decisions and daily routines are critical. It might be a major part of the equation. Maybe it's 20%, maybe it's 30% of the equation. And And maybe that's irresponsible to even try to put a number on it. But in my view, the vast majority, and from the scientific literature that I can't help but clicking on every link that comes across. I mean, my Google News is basically the latest mental health studies. Probably 30% of my Google News algorithm is now set to following this. It has been for a while. It's the latest scientific literature seems to suggest that there are immense things from extremely commonplace, simple tactics like exercise and proper diet that are critical, that are a large part of the equation. But the literature also seems to suggest that the majority of the equation is outside of that person's control. That's why diabetes always comes to mind as the apt metaphor. And a similar ailment where there is an equation of both behavioral and circumstantial chemistry that is happening, that the person cannot just snap their fingers, make a choice, and get themselves out of what, as of today, is an incurable disease. The last thing I will touch on before getting into some of the resources for how to avoid mental health tragedy, and if you are someone listening to this because you are navigating being on the other side of someone taking their own life, then you probably are thinking, okay, this may run in the family, or I know someone else that is in a similar situation of despair. So that, like I touched on, that avoidance is, it's thoughts around avoiding such a tragedy again are natural. But the last thing I will say about my experience with a family member taking their own life, I always think about this phrase that in an interview that I heard Stephen Colbert say. He lost family members in a plane crash, including his father, and I believe his multiple brothers, in a plane crash when he was young. And he wondered if he would ever laugh again. I remember similarly wondering if I would ever laugh again that night, that day, that week. I don't know why that question has always stuck with me. Of the thing I kept asking myself was, will I ever laugh again? I imagine that was in some way a euphemism for, will there be a permanent removal of joy in my life? And I think about this interview that Stephen Colbert gave where he said he wondered if he would ever laugh again. And on the way home from the funeral, they're in the hired car that's driving them away from the cemetery, and he and his sisters, something happened and they just all started dying laughing. He said he was keeled over, crying, laughing. Something that he worried he'd never do again. He was just dazed from laughing so hard that it brought tears to his eyes on the drive away from the cemetery. And he said in that interview that losing his father and brothers in that accident became the most beautiful experience he would have never designed. And I think about that articulation because it's true. Now, I have no idea how you're coming across this episode. If someone's sending this to you, a day after a tragedy, then this may rightfully feel impossible and irrelevant to you. But what I've seen in being that phone call over the last two decades that people make multiple times a year when they lose someone through major depression or mental illness, I find myself saying this more than almost anything else. Reciting that quote from Stephen Colbert and mapping it to my experience. What in the abstract can seem and feel like absolute tragedy and having no redeeming value, all downside, no upside, I can say from my experience that going through such a tragedy, it to someone that hasn't been through it, that articulation, the most beautiful thing you would have never designed, sounds sacrilegious. But I think having an intimate experience with death, whether you are worried about it for your friend, whether you're worried about how the siblings might react, whether you're worried about it for the people around, how they will react, bounce back or not bounce back. I can tell you from my experience, there is an element of post-traumatic growth that happens when exposed to death so intimately. And it is fairly hard to describe, but there is this amount of growth that happens that in some ways could only happen from the exposure, the intimate exposure to reality. That death is the ultimate reality. Every day that I'm alive, I think about that inevitability. It is not something that I'm able to push away, sweep under the rug, or ignore. It is something that when you come undesirably, uncomfortably close to, I think it activates something in the human spirit that cannot be activated otherwise. If you're 5 days on the other side of this type of tragedy, I don't know how much or how little that quote from Stephen Colbert will help you. But if you're a month on the other side, if you're 6 months, if you're a year, if you're 5 years, I think you see the sprouts from the seeds of truth within that articulation. I think when you experience, you have exposure to something like that, and this is what I told my friend 2 days ago, that it activates you in a way where you become a better friend, a better father, a better mother, a better sibling, a better child. When there's no more delusions that the great equalizer is not going to be a part of your story, when you realize it, life is so fragile, so fragile. And you realize it in such an intimate way. I think it is the most profound teacher that none of us would ever sign up for a class with. And said in a way that I don't think I could articulate it any better, with untold and infinite implications within it. It is, to use Stephen Colbert's words, from my experience, the most beautiful thing that one would never design. If there is a takeaway from this, I hope that it is around the fact that this is not a choice that someone makes on that Friday evening. That behind that acute event, there is a backdrop of illness that is still poorly defined in our current culture, but even worse, poorly understood, and even worse, poorly discussed. If there's a second takeaway, I hope that it is beyond mental illness being in many ways more akin to diabetes of the mind, the brain, than our conventional view of just mindset, and you can snap out of it, and that you, I've heard it described that when dopamine is low enough, a lab rat, when the dopamine is low enough, will not travel the length of its own body for food. It will eat food if it's right there. But if its biochemistry is off enough, it won't even travel the length of its body for food. It would rather starve to death. That is not a pep talk away if someone is in that state. That's how distorted. It's like trying to sober someone up with a conversation. If there's a second takeaway, it's that talking about mental illness, and especially talking about your own experiences if you've been through it, and the things that got you to the other side, that allows not only, it's not even about you talking about tactics to get the other side, it's about you then becoming a known entity in a network, in a community, in someone's life, for them to reach out to you for 15 minutes. And I think a 15 minute conversation with someone that has been there before, having that conversation and that foundation for maybe further conversations based in the reality of your circumstance, as hard as that might be, to write that text saying, hey, can we connect for a few minutes? I think you may have gone through something that I'm going through, and I'd love to hear how you got through it. That one sentence text I know can be incredibly hard, but I can tell you 15 minutes of conversation around a foundation of what's really going on versus a decade of denial, of hoping that you'll just get through it or it will solve itself. I think it is a no-brainer. It is so much better to have that conversation as the foundation than the conditions that lead to many of us denying that we're going through something that may not solve itself. And I think that out of all of the resources I've ever seen, I think people connecting with someone that has been there before, it's like the quote of, the only thing you need to know is where the library is. It's almost like the only thing you need to know is where are the other resources, and that is the wellspring for which all the other resources can come to you. Having that conversation with someone that's been there, that might be a few years ahead, that might be a decade ahead of where you are, it is the wellspring for which so many other resources can come to you. But they can come to you in a very personal way. I also think you talking about it out loud is so simple but profoundly powerful, to talk about what you're going through out loud. It can shrink the problem nearly instantaneously from this thing that, especially when you're going through it in an isolated way, can be so scary, so big, so massive, that it blocks out any sunlight in your life. And yet talking about it out loud can actually potentially give some almost immediate perspective, immediate relief of you doing the talking. Not necessarily about what someone else will say. The third thing that, and then the last thing that I leave you with is, or that I hope is the takeaway, is if you've gone through something like this, that you realize in the internal monologues you might have of what you said or didn't say or could have, should have done that you think was a difference maker, that is largely bullshit. A conversation was not going to change an acute event for which a backdrop was a major illness. Saying the right thing, putting the words in the right order was not going to change, it's not going to sober someone up that has a distorted view. It is not a difference maker that you might think, wonder, or beat yourself up about, when the truth is the fundamental backdrop was an illness. One that could not be talked away. An illness that we poorly understand, as I said, but we know enough to know that when someone's biochemistry is off, that it is, it has massive, massively significant effects on their life that are not remedied by what someone next to them does or doesn't do. I want to send out love to anyone that is going through this, that is searching for answers, and maybe this is only 3% comforting for the continued search for answers or closure that they might be on, and it might be one of these events in life that just never has closure to it. But I know that over the last 20 years of seeking closure to something that I'll never get closure around within my own life, it's not necessary closure that I've ever gotten, but it is this understanding that I'm sharing with you today. If you are looking for ways to avoid this type of tragedy that could be described as a irrational choice from a distorted perspective. And I think one of the most important things that I could say to you is, similarly to if someone is going through this deep, dark circumstance, reaching out to someone to talk is so profoundly powerful. Even for 15 minutes. Thing that I can say to you, if you're a family member, you can also reach out to and should reach out to someone you know that's a family member that has been through something like this, even before tragedy exists. One of the things that I actually see that is as prevalent as the denial when someone is going through a mental illness, it's a denial that seems It's understandable. I mean, even with my heart condition, I denied it for probably 2 or 3 years, thinking, no, no, if I change this, it's not real diagnosis. And yeah, after a while, it sets in, okay, this is the new normal. And yes, there was a life before this diagnosis, but this is the new normal. And every one of us will go through something where we get diagnosed with something at some point in our lives where there is a new normal. And a mental illness where it requires a daily routine to help avoid its pitfalls is, it's honestly, it's a lot like physical fitness. It requires, maybe there's a time in your life when you didn't need a daily routine, but mental fitness and physical fitness are very similar in that regard, that it's only a matter of time before all of us have new daily routines to support our mental and physical health. But I've seen this denial from family members where they also don't want to, they hear something so scary as a friend or a family member saying that they're depressed and scary or flat out extremely inconvenient to hear. And there can be a tendency to not take it seriously. And maybe that's colored by your own perspective where you haven't dealt with it, but you thought you were depressed for 2 weeks. You weren't quite that as depressed as this, but you felt like you got out of it by waiting a few days. That might have been the case for you. Not all family members are going to be affected with true diabetes, even if all of them might be have the preconditions for it. But when someone has a true mental illness, it is like major depression or bipolar. It is a big part of first symptoms to diagnosis being 10 years is because those people around them also convince themselves that it is not a problem worth worrying about. It's not a major issue. Most suicides actually have cries for help beforehand. And though I don't think this can be a major, major shift when someone is in the absolute depths, early on, it can be helpful to take this as seriously as possible. In the link, in the description of the episode, there's a resource for if someone tells you they're thinking about suicide. And it's a real conversation guide. And one of the first things that is recommended, the first thing, is to let them know that you are glad they're telling you. An example would be, I'm so glad you're telling me about how much has been going on and how you're feeling. Thank you for sharing this with me. The reason that suggested language is so powerful is because if you show that you're scared by hearing their inner thoughts that they have already been waiting months or years to tell you, because they know they are so scary to themselves, they know that it could be scary for you. If you react with fright, it's going to confirm their intuition or their instinct that it is too scary to talk about. During COVID, I had a guest on the podcast that mentioned 1 in 11 people contemplated suicide during the first year of the pandemic. 1 in 11. If you saw 30 people that day, that was 3 people that you saw during the course of the day that during the course of those 12 months had contemplated suicide. It is far more common than we think. And when you become a resource that is listening to someone going through that and they don't have to go through it in isolation, a resource that's glad to hear what they're going through, it's creating the space that is extremely accommodating for any conversation they want to have, that environment, that relationship, that conversation, those communications are incredibly powerful. It's not what you say or what you don't say necessarily that can fix anything, but it does create the conditions for which they don't have to go through it alone. I'm so glad you're telling me about how much has been going on and how you're feeling. Thank you for sharing this with me. That's the suggested language for the first thing to do. And it says to show your support, saying something like, I'm right here with you. Or nothing you're going through changes how I feel about you and how awesome I think you are. We can get through this together. And then finally, it's the encouragement for them to keep talking. The situation sounds really difficult. And I want to encourage you, if you want to keep talking about it right now, or if this is enough for now, we can chat about it again later today or tomorrow. And then after the conversation, I'll also say during the conversation, be direct. If you suspect they're thinking about suicide, do not beat around the bush. If someone is in that place, that inability to create, to imagine a future, it is going to be very irrationally rational for them to think about suicide or hurting themselves. And you beating around the bush because you're scared of the world is too connected for someone to not know that is a potential approach. And like I said, the majority of people that have these thoughts do not commit suicide. So you don't have to worry about priming them or being the first one to suggest that is something that could happen. In fact, all of the advice, professional advice out there suggests you should hit it head on by saying, are you thinking about killing yourself? Are you thinking about hurting yourself? Does it ever get so tough that you think about ending your life? And you want to make sure you don't sound like you're passing judgment. Don't say, you're not thinking of doing something stupid, are you? You don't say that. Do not add a guilt trip. That's one of the biggest reasons that people consider suicide is because they feel like they are a burden on those around them. So do not say things like, think of what it could do to your parents. Don't shame them for what they're feeling. And again, it would be as irrational as saying, you have diabetes, what will that do to everybody around you? So instead, reassure them that you understand and care. I really care about you, and I want you to know you can tell me anything. It is common to have thoughts about hurting yourself when you're feeling this way, and I want you to know you can tell me anything. And then you can even ask them. You can approach it head on. Sunlight is a phenomenal disinfectant. How often are you having these thoughts? And when it gets really bad, what do you do? And what scares you about these thoughts? And what do you need to do? How can I help for you to feel safe? And then you can reassure them that the good news is help is out there. The majority of people that have these thoughts do not end up taking their life, and help is out there. You can take a break or follow their lead to continue the conversation and let them know that it's clear you're struggling, and I think it would be really helpful for you to continue to talk to people about this. And I can even come over there and help you find a resource that's within your insurance network. It's very easy. If you just tell me your insurance, then we can find one that's in your network to start having those conversations, or help you download an app. BetterHelp is a great one. Cerebral is another great one that you can have a conversation through the privacy of an app on your couch, on your phone, around how you're feeling. And I think BetterHelp is a great one to start with because it is talk therapy. And help them connect with with that mental health professional through an app on their phone or their computer, and you can offer and say, I can drive over to where you are, and we can connect. You can go through the first session of therapy, and then we can even have a coffee afterwards. So the resource that I'll link to has additional information if they refuse help, and things that and other resources beyond what's just what I just suggested. But for someone that's starting in a cold start, maybe re-listen to the last 5 minutes of this episode, and then check out the links provided within the description. My heart goes out to anyone that is on either side of this tragedy. And this type of tragedy, it is one that I can tell you, if you are on the other side, what makes it so more complicated is these feelings of if someone passes away in a car accident, there are immediate, and you are 10 miles away, there's an immediate backdrop of there's nothing you could have done, or you didn't do too much of something or too little of something else. What makes this really difficult and the processing is that it's like you're a doctor and you lost a patient on the table, and that patient was someone you loved deeply. And you feel incorrectly, it is not an accurate perspective, but it is this feeling of guilt that you could have done something else, should have done something else. There are also the presence of feelings that your community around you feels like, well, you were there. Why didn't you do more? Or what did you do that contributed? You were in the operating room. And that goes back to this cultural misunderstanding of what mental illness is. If you lose someone in a car accident, you get the immediate enveloping of the community around you, empathy, understanding, and this is a bit dicier because of that cultural lack of understanding. I know when my sister passed away, there was a bit of community processing that kept us at arm's length, that felt like whatever we just went through, this great tragedy, was so unnecessary. There can also be anger at what that person did and the collateral damage around them because of that irrational choice and the distorted perspective, which, like I said, can hardly be, I don't think should be categorized as a choice when your biochemistry is distorting your viewpoint so much. But it's understandable that there's anger because you feel like they could have easily made a different choice. And that person with a rational perspective likely would have made a different choice. But when there is a disorder of this magnitude involved, when there's no longer a denial that this disorder not only exists, but is extremely prevalent, that mental illness is responsible for more deaths today than all violent crime and warfare combined, then it is a healthy dose of understanding that helps dissipate the complications of such a tragedy. I would end this episode by saying, if you know someone that is in the aftermath on the other side of a tragedy like this, that you can share a link to this episode with them. But the truth is, with the prevalence of mental illness, with how much it has, does, and will affect each of us, directly and indirectly, we are all in the scenario before a tragedy like this can happen around us. And if you've been through it before, then maybe you're like me, where you're still in a situation where you know it could still happen again. So feel free to share this episode with anyone that you think might benefit from hearing it.